Simon & Schuster Audio presents American Assassin by Vince Flynn. Read by George Goodell.
Prelude. Beirut, Lebanon. Mitch Rapp stared at his reflection in the dusty, cracked mirror and questioned his sanity. There was no shaking or sweaty palms. He wasn't nervous. It was just a cold, calculated assessment of his abilities and his odds for success. He went over the plan once more from start to finish and again concluded it was likely that he would be severely beaten, tortured, and possibly killed. But even in the face of such prospects, he couldn't bring himself to walk away, which brought him right smack dab back to that part about his mental health. What kind of man willingly chose to do such a thing? Rapp thought about it for a long moment, and then decided someone else would have to answer that question. While everyone else seemed content to sit on their hands, it was not in Rapp's nature to do so. Two of his colleagues had been grabbed from the streets of Beirut by a nasty little outfit called Islamic Jihad. They were a tentacle of Hezbollah that specialized in kidnapping, torture, and suicide bombings. The jihadis had, without question, already begun the interrogation of their new prisoners. They would expose the men to unthinkable pain, and they would begin to peel back each layer of the onion until they got what they wanted. That was the savage truth. And if his colleagues could delude themselves into thinking otherwise, it just meant they had consciously or unconsciously gravitated toward convenient conclusions. After a day of watching the very people who said they would handle the situation do nothing, Rapp decided to look for a solution on his own. The bureaucrats and foreign service types back in Washington might be content with letting things take their natural course, but Rapp was not. He'd been through too much to allow his cover to be blown, and beyond that there was that nagging little thing about honor and the warrior's code. He'd been through the ringer with these guys. One he respected, admired, and liked. The other he respected, admired, and hated. The pull for him to do something, anything, to save them, was strong. The gang back in Washington might be able to simply write off losing the faceless operatives as a cost of war. But to the guys who were in the trenches, it was a little more personal. Warriors don't like leaving their own to die at the hands of the enemy, because secretly they all know they might be in the same position one day, and they sure as hell hope their country will do everything in their power to get them back. Rapp eyed his fractured reflection, his thick uncombed head of black hair and beard, his bronzed olive skin and his eyes so dark that they were almost black. He could walk among the enemy without attracting so much as a suspicious glance. But that would all change if he didn't do something. He thought of his training and everything he'd sacrificed. The entire operation would be exposed, and that meant his career in the field would be over. He'd be stuffed behind some desk back in Washington, where he'd rot for the next 25 years. He'd wake up each morning and go to bed each night with the nagging thought that he should have done something, anything. And ultimately he would emasculate himself by questioning the size of his balls for as long as he lived. Rapp shuddered at the thought. He might be a little crazy, but he'd read enough Greek tragedies to understand that a life filled with that kind of recrimination would eventually lead him to the psych ward. No, he thought. I'd rather go down swinging. He nodded to himself and took a deep breath before walking over to the window. Rapp gently pulled back the tattered curtain and looked down at the street. The two foot soldiers from Islamic Jihad were still positioned across the street, keeping an eye on things. Rapp had dropped a few hints around the neighborhood about what he was up to, and they had shown up barely an hour after he had pressed his $700 bill into the willing hand of a local merchant. Rapp had considered killing one lackey and interrogating the other, but new word would spread so fast that his colleagues would be either moved or killed before he could act on whatever intel he could gather. Rapp shook his head. This was it. There was only one avenue open to him, and there was no sense in delaying what had to be done. He quickly scrawled a note and left it on the small desk in the corner. He gathered his sunglasses, the map, and a large wad of cash and headed for the door. The elevator was broken, so he walked the four flights to the lobby. The new man behind the front desk looked nervous as all hell, which Rapp took as a sign that someone had talked to him. He continued out the front door into the blazing daylight and held his map above his head to block the sun while he looked up and down the street. Looking out from behind the sunglasses, he pretended not to notice the duo from Islamic Jihad. With his face buried in the map, he turned to the right and started heading east. Within half a block, Rapp's nervous system began sending his brain alarms, each more frantic than the previous one. It took every ounce of control to override his training and millions of years of basic survival instincts that were embedded like code into the human brain. Up ahead, the familiar black car was parked across the street. Rapp ignored the man behind the wheel and turned down a narrow side street. Just 30 paces ahead, a rough-looking man was stationed in front of a shop. His left leg was straight and firmly planted on the pavement, and the other bent up behind him and placed against the side of the building. His big frame was resting against the building while he took a long drag off his cigarette. There was something vaguely familiar about him, right down to the dusty black pants and the white dress shirt with the sweat-stained armpits. The street was otherwise empty. The survivors of the bloody Civil War could smell trouble, and they had wisely decided to stay indoors until the morning sideshow was concluded. The footfalls from behind were echoing like heavy shoes on the stone floor of an empty cathedral. Rapp could hear the pace of his pursuers quicken. A car engine revved, no doubt the black BMW he'd already spotted. With every step, Rapp could feel them closing in from behind. His brain ran through scenarios with increasing rapidity, looking for any way out of the impending disaster. They were close now. Rapp could feel them. The big fellow up ahead threw his cigarette to the ground and pushed himself away from the building with a little more spring than Rapp would have guessed him capable of. He filed that away. The man smiled at him and produced a leather truncheon from his pocket. Rapp dropped the map and feigned surprise and turned to flee. The two men were exactly where he expected them to be, guns drawn, one pointed at Rapp's head, the other at his chest. The sedan skidded to a stop just to his right, the trunk and front passenger door swinging open. Rapp knew what was next. He closed his eyes and clenched his jaw as the truncheon cracked him across the back of the head. Rapp stumbled forward and willingly fell into the arms of the two men with pistols. He let his legs go limp, and the men struggled with his weight. He felt the arms of the big man wrap around his chest and yank him upright. His 9mm Beretta was pulled from the back of his waistband, and he was dragged the short distance to the car's trunk. Rapp landed headfirst with a thud. The rest of his body was folded in on top of him, and then the trunk was slammed shut. The engine roared, and the rear tires bit through a layer of sand and dirt until they found asphalt. Rapp was thrown back as the vehicle shot away. He slowly cracked open his eyes, and as expected, he found himself enveloped in darkness. His head was throbbing a bit from the blow, but not too badly. There was no fear on his face or doubt in his mind, though. Just a smile on his lips as he thought of his plan. The seeds of disinformation that he had spread over the past day had drawn them in just as he'd hoped. His captors had no idea of the true intent of the man they now had in their possession. And more important, no idea of the violence and mayhem he was about to visit upon them. Part 1. Chapter 1. Southern Virginia. 1 year earlier. Mitch Rapp removed the blindfold from his face and raised his seat back. The brown Ford Taurus sedan rocked its way down a rutted gravel road, twin plumes of dust corkscrewing into the hot August air. The blindfold was a precaution in case he failed, which Rapp had no intention of doing. He stared out the window at the thick wall of pines that bracketed the lane. Even with the bright sun, he could see no more than 30 feet into the dark maze of trees and underbrush. As a child, he'd always found the woods to be an inviting place. But on this particular afternoon, it had a decidedly more ominous feel. A foreboding premonition hijacked his thoughts and sent his mind careening into a place that he did not want to go. At least not this afternoon. Still, a frown creased his brow as Rapp wondered how many men had died in this particular forest, and he wasn't thinking of the men who had fought in the Civil War all those years earlier. No, he thought, trying to be completely honest with himself. Death was too open-ended a word for it. It left the possibility that some accident had befallen the person, and that was a convenient way to skirt the seriousness of what he was getting himself into. Executed was a far more accurate word. The men he was thinking of had been marched into these very woods, shot in the back of the head, and dumped into freshly dug holes, never to be heard from again. That was the world that Rapp was about to enter, and he was utterly and completely at peace with his decision. Still, a sliver of doubt sliced through the curtains of his mind and caused a flash of hesitation. Rapp wrestled with it for a moment, and then stuffed it back into the deepest recesses of his brain. Now was not the time for second thoughts. He'd been over this, around it, and under it. He'd studied it from every conceivable angle since the day the mysterious woman had walked into his life. In a strange way, he knew where it was all headed, from almost the first moment she'd looked at him with those discerning, penetrating eyes. He had been waiting for someone to show up, though Rapp had never told her that. Or that the only way he could cope with the pain of losing the love of his life was to plot his revenge. That every single night before he went to sleep, he thought of the network of faceless men who had plotted to bring down Pan Am Flight 103. That he saw himself on this very journey, headed to a remote place not dissimilar from the woods he now found himself in. It was all logical to him. Enemies needed to be killed. And Rapp was more than willing to become the person who would do that killing. He knew what was about to happen. He was to be trained, honed, and forged into an ultimate precision weapon. And then he would begin to hunt them down, every last one of the faceless men who had conspired to kill all those innocent civilians on that cold December night. The car began to slow, and Rapp looked up to see a rusted cattle gate with a heavy chain and padlock. His dark brow furrowed with suspicion. The woman driving the vehicle glanced sideways at him and said, "You were expecting something a little more high-tech, perhaps." Rapp nodded silently. Irene Kennedy put the car in park and said, "Appearances can be very deceiving." She opened her door and stepped from the vehicle. As she walked to the gate, she listened. A moment later, she heard the click of the passenger door and she smiled. Without an ounce of training, he had made the right decision. From their very first meeting, it was apparent he was different. She had audited every detail of his life and watched him from afar for several months. Kennedy was exceedingly good at her job. She was methodical, organized, and patient. She also had a photographic memory. Kennedy had grown up in the business. Her father had worked for the State Department, and the vast majority of her education had taken place overseas in countries where an American was not always welcome. Vigilance was a part of her daily routine from the age of 5. While other parents worried about their kids wandering out into the street and getting hit by a car, Kennedy's parents worried about her finding a bomb under their car. It was drilled into her to always be aware of her surroundings. When Kennedy finally introduced herself to Rapp, he studied her for a long second and then asked why she'd been following him. At the time, Rapp was only 22, with no formal training. If Kennedy had a weakness, it was with improvisation. She liked things plotted out well in advance, and being so thorough, she had gone in assuming the novice would have no idea that she'd been running surveillance on him. She had recruited dozens of people, and this was a first. Kennedy was caught off guard to the point of stammering for an answer. The recruit was supposed to be the one struggling to understand what was going on. Rapp's recognizing her was not part of the script. Later, in her motel room outside Syracuse, she retraced her every move over the past months and tried to figure out where she had slipped. After 3 hours and 17 pages of notes, she still couldn't pinpoint her mistake. With frustration and grudging admiration, she had concluded that Rapp had extremely acute situational awareness. She moved his file to the top of her stack and made a bold decision. Rather than use the normal people, she contacted a firm run by some retired spooks. They were old friends of her father's, who specialized in handling jobs without creating a paper trail. She asked them to take an objective look at Rapp just in case she had missed something. 2 weeks later, they came back with a summary that sent chills up Kennedy's spine. Kennedy took that report straight to her boss, Thomas Stansfield. Midway through reading the file, he suspected what she was up to. When he finished, he slowly closed the 2-inch-thick biography of the young Mitch Rapp and made her plead her case. She was concise and to the point, but still, Stansfield pointed out the potential pitfalls and obvious dangers of leapfrogging the initial phase of training. She countered perfectly. The game was changing. He had said it himself many times. They couldn't sit back and play defense, and in this ever more interconnected world, they needed a weapon more surgical than any guided bomb or cruise missile. Having spent many years in the field himself, Stansfield also knew this person would have to be uniquely autonomous, someone who conveniently had no official record. Kennedy ticked off 8 additional reasons why she felt this young man was the perfect candidate. Her logic was sound, but beyond that there was the simple fact that they had to begin somewhere. By Stansfield's reckoning, this was an endeavor they should have started a good 5 years earlier, so it was with a heavy sigh and a leap of faith that he decided to proceed. He told Kennedy to forego the normal training and bring him to the only man they knew who was crazy enough to try to mold a green recruit into what they needed. If Rapp could survive 6 months of schooling at the hands of Stan Hurley, he might indeed be the weapon they were looking for. Before she left, Stansfield told her to eliminate any connection. Every last file, surveillance photo, and recording that could ever tie them to Rapp was to be destroyed. Kennedy pulled the car through the gate and asked Rapp to close and lock it behind them. Rapp did as he was asked and then got back in the car. 100 yards later, Kennedy slowed the vehicle to a crawl and maneuvered diagonally in an effort to avoid a large pothole. "Why no security on the perimeter?" Rapp asked. "The high-tech systems, more often than not, they draw too much unwanted attention. They also give a lot of false alarms, which in turn requires a lot of manpower. That's not what this place is about." "What about dogs?" Rapp asked. She liked the way he was thinking. As if on cue, 2 hounds came galloping around the bend. The dogs charged straight at the vehicle. Kennedy stopped and waited for them to get out of her way. A moment later, after baring their teeth, they turned and bolted back in the direction they'd just come from. Kennedy took her foot off the brake and proceeded up the lane. "This man," Kennedy said, "the one who will be training you." "The crazy little guy who's going to try to kill me?" Rapp said without smiling. "I didn't say he was going to try to kill you. I said he's going to try to make you think he's trying to kill you." "Very comforting," Rapp said sarcastically. "Why do you keep bringing him up?" "I want you to be prepared." Rapp thought about that for a moment and said, "I am. Or at least, as prepared as you can be for something like this." She considered that for a moment. "The physical part is assumed. We know you're in good shape, and that's important, but I want you to know that you will be pushed in ways you never imagined. It's a game, one that's designed to make you quit. Your greatest asset will be mental discipline, not physical strength." Rapp disagreed with her, but kept his mouth shut and his face a mask of neutrality. To be the best required equal doses of both. He knew the game. He'd been through plenty of grueling football and lacrosse practices in the humid August heat of Virginia. And back then, it was only a simple desire to play that kept him going. Now his motivation to succeed was much deeper, far more personal. "Just try to remember, none of it is personal," Kennedy said. Rapp smiled inwardly. "That's where you're wrong," he thought. "It's all personal." When he responded, however, he was compliant. "I know," Rapp said in an easy tone. "What about these other guys?" If there was one thing that made him a little nervous, it was this. The other recruits had been down here for 2 days. Rapp didn't like getting a late start. They would have already begun the bonding process and were likely to resent his showing up late. He didn't understand the delay, but she wasn't exactly forthright with information. "There are 6 of them." Kennedy scrolled through the photos in her mind's eye. She had read their jackets. They all had military experience and shared, at least on paper, many of Rapp's qualities. They were all dark-featured, athletic, capable of violence, or at least not afraid of it, and they had all to one degree or another passed the extensive psychological exams. They had all showed a facility for foreign languages. In terms of a sense of right and wrong, they all hovered near that critical 6 o'clock position on the mental health pie chart, that thin line that separated law enforcement officers from career criminals. Around the next bend, the landscape opened up before them. A freshly mowed lawn, roughly the size of a football field, ran along both sides of the lane, all the way to a white barn and two-story house with a wraparound porch. This was not what Rapp had expected. The place looked like a rural postcard, complete with a set of rocking chairs on a big white porch. A man appeared from inside the house. He was holding a cup of coffee in one hand and a cigarette in the other. Rapp watched him move across the porch. The man swiveled his head to the left and then right in a casual manner. Most people would have missed it. But Rapp's senses had been opened to the reality that the world was divided between those who were part of the herd and those who liked to hunt. The man was checking his flanks. He stopped at the top of the porch steps and looked down at them from behind a pair of aviator sunglasses. Rapp smiled ever so slightly at the realization that this was the man who was going to try to break him. It was a challenge he'd been looking forward to for some time. Chapter 2 Rapp looked through the bug-splattered windshield at the ballbuster he'd been warned about. Even from across the yard, he could see the displeased look on the guy's face. He had medium-length brown hair swept to the right and a full Tom Selleck mustache. He was in a pair of faded olive shorts that were a little on the small side and a white V-neck T-shirt. As the car came to a stop, Rapp noted the faded black combat boots and white tube socks that were pulled all the way up to his knees. His skin was a leathery, dark brown, and all of it, even his cheeks, seemed tightly wound with muscles and tendons. Rapp wondered about the eyes that were conveniently concealed behind a pair of sunglasses. He thought about his plan, and he figured he'd find out soon enough. "How old is he?" Rapp asked. "Not sure," Kennedy said as she put the car in park. "He's older than he looks, though, but I wouldn't bring it up. He doesn't like talking about his age." She unbuckled her seatbelt. "Wait here for a moment." Kennedy exited the vehicle and walked casually across the gravel driveway. She was wearing black dress slacks and a white blouse. Due to the heat and the fact that they were more than 100 miles from headquarters, she'd left her suit jacket in the back seat. A 9mm Beretta pistol was on her right hip, more to avoid a tongue-lashing from the man she was about to face than from any real fear that she'd have to use it. She looked up at the man on the porch and brushed a loose strand of her auburn hair behind her ear. Stopping at the base of the porch steps, she said, "Uncle Stan, you don't look too excited to see me." Stan Hurley glanced down at Kennedy and felt a twinge of guilt. This little beauty could jerk his emotions around in ways very few could. He'd known Irene longer than she'd known herself. He'd watched her grow up, bought her Christmas presents from strange, exotic places, and spent more holidays with the Kennedys than without them. And then, a little less than a decade ago, all the joy had drained from their lives when a delivery van packed with over 2,000 pounds of explosives pulled up to the U.S. Embassy in Beirut. 63 people perished, including Kennedy's father. Hurley had been away screwing one of his sources and had narrowly dodged the bullet. The CIA had lost 8 valuable people that April day, and they'd been playing catch-up ever since. Hurley was well aware that he had almost no control over his temper, so it was his habit to keep things brief when he was upset and talking with someone he liked. He said simply, "Afternoon, Irene." Kennedy had been expecting and dreading this moment for some months. Normally, Hurley would have greeted her with a warm hug and asked her how her mother was, but not this afternoon. She'd done an end-around on him, and Stan Hurley did not like people going over his head for approval on something this serious. The chill in his mood was obvious, but still, she pressed on, asking, "How are you feeling?" Hurley ignored her question and pointedly asked, "Who's in the car?"
"New recruit. Thomas told me he filled you in." Kennedy was referring to their boss.
Hurley's eyes were shielded by the polarized lenses of his aviators. His head slowly swiveled away from the car toward Kennedy. "Yes, he told me what you were up to," he said with obvious disapproval.
Kennedy defensively folded her arms across her chest and said, "You don't endorse my decision."
"Absolutely not."
"Why?"
"I don't run a damn Boy Scout camp."
"Never said you did, Stan," Kennedy said in a biting tone.
"Then why the hell are you wasting my time sending me some titty boy college puke who doesn't know the difference between a gun and a rifle?"
The normally stoic Kennedy allowed a bit of irritation to show. She was well aware of the special hold she had over Hurley, and a look of disapproval on her part was far more potent than a direct attack. Hurley looked down at her and could see she was unhappy with him. He didn't like that one bit. It was the same with his own daughters. If one of his boys had so much as looked at him sideways, he would have knocked him on his ass. But the girls had the ability to get past all his defenses, get inside him and create doubt. Still, on this issue, he knew he was right, so he held his ground.
"Don't make this personal, Irene. I've been at this a long time, and I know what I'm doing. I don't need you going over my head and then coming down here and dumping some untested rookie in my lap."
Kennedy stood sphinx-like, refusing to yield her position. Hurley took a drag from his cigarette and said,
"I think you should save us all the headache and get back in your car and take him back to wherever you found him."
Kennedy was surprised by the genuine resentment she felt. She'd been working on this for more than a year. Her analysis and her instincts told her Rapp was just the man they were looking for. Yet here she was being dismissed like some complete neophyte who had no understanding of what they were trying to accomplish. Kennedy slowly climbed the porch steps and squared off with Hurley. The veteran backed up a bit, obviously uncomfortable with someone whom he wouldn't dare lay a hand on entering his personal space.
"I got a lot of work to take care of this afternoon, Irene, so the sooner you get back in the car, the better off we'll all be."
Kennedy squared her shoulders and, in a tight voice, asked, "Uncle Stan, have I ever disrespected you?"
"That's not what this is.
It's exactly what it's about. What have I done to you that has caused you to hold me in such low regard?" She inched closer.
Hurley's feet began to shuffle, his face twisted into a scowl.
"You know I think the world of you."
"Then why do you treat me as if I'm still a teenager?"
"I don't think you're incompetent."
"You just think I should stick to analysis and leave the recruiting and training to you." He cleared his throat and said,
"I think that's a fair statement."
Kennedy put her hands on her hips and stuck out her chin.
"Do me a favor and take off your sunglasses."
The request caught Hurley off guard.
"Why?"
"Because I know your Achilles heel, and I want to see your womanizing eyes when I tell you what someone should have told you a long time ago."
Hurley cracked a smile in an attempt to brush her off, but she told him again to take his glasses off. Hurley reluctantly did so.
"I respect you," Kennedy said. "In fact, I might trust you more with my life than anyone in this world. You are unquestionably the best man to whip these operatives into shape. But there's one problem."
"What's that?"
"You're myopic."
"Really?"
"Yep. I'm not sure you really understand the type of person we're looking for."
Hurley scoffed as if the idea was preposterous.
"That's right. And you're too stubborn to see it."
"I suppose you think the Special Operations Group just showed up one day. Who do you think trained all those guys? Who do you think selected them? Who do you think turned them into the efficient, badass killing machines that they are?"
"You did. And you know that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about our third objective."
Hurley frowned. She knew right where to hit him. He quietly wondered if Stansfield had put her up to this and said,
"You think this shit's easy? You want to take over running this little operation?"
Kennedy shook her head and smiled in amazement.
"You know, for a tough guy, you're awfully thin-skinned. You sound like one of those damn desk jockeys back at Langley who run their section as if they were some third-world dictator."
She might as well have hit him in the gut with a 2x4. Hurley stood there speechless.
"You've created a cult of personality," Kennedy continued. "Every single recruit is you 20 to 30 years ago."
"And what's wrong with that?"
"Nothing. if you're talking about our first two objectives. Kennedy held up one finger. Training operatives with the skills to get down and dirty if they have to, and, she held up a second finger, creating a highly mobile tactical assault team, but when it comes to the third, she shook her head. We're still at the starting gate. Hurley didn't like hearing this, but he was not some unaware idiot. He knew what he'd been tasked to do, and he was acutely aware that he had so far failed to make any progress on the most delicate of the three programs. Still, it wasn't in him to cede the point so easily.
I can teach anyone how to kill, that's easy. You point the weapon, you pull the trigger, and assuming you can aim, bam, a piece of lead enters the target's body, hits a vital organ, and is done. If you've got big enough balls, I can teach you to slide a knife through a guy's armpit and pop his heart like a balloon. Fuck, I can show you 1,000 ways to punch someone's ticket. I can teach you battlefield techniques until I'm blue in the face.
But? Kennedy asked, prodding him in the direction she knew he was headed.
Turning a man into what we're looking for, Hurley stopped and shook his head. It just ain't that easy.
Kennedy sighed. This was the opening she was looking for. Touching Hurley's arm, she said, I'm not saying it is, which is why you have to start trusting the rest of us to do our jobs. I have brought you a gift, Stan. You don't realize it right now, because you think a guy has to go through boot camp before he's ready to have a run at your selection process, and normally I would agree with you. But this is different. You're just going to have to let go of some of your control issues for a bit. What I have in that car is exactly what you've been looking for, Stan. No bad habits that'll take you months to undo. None of that stiff military discipline that makes all these guys stand out like a sore thumb when we dump them into an urban setting. Hurley glanced at the car. He's off the charts on all of our tests, Kennedy added, and he's yours for the shaping. With a deep frown, Hurley studied what little he could see of this raw lump of coal that Kennedy was about to dump in his lap. That is, Kennedy said, if you can swallow your pride and admit that the little girl you used to bounce on your knee is all grown up and just might be better at spotting talent than you. Checkmate, Hurley thought to himself. I'm stuck with this puke, at least for a few days until I can figure out how to make him quit.
Fine, he said with a defeated tone, but no special favors. He pulls his weight just like everyone else, or he's gone.
I don't expect any favors, but, Kennedy said, pointing a finger at his face, I am going to be very upset if I find out you singled him out and gave him some of your famous extra love and attention.
Hurley digested her words and then gave her a curt nod. Fine. I'll do it your way, but trust me. If I so much as get a whiff of weakness,
I know. I know, she said, robbing him of the final word. You'll make him wish he'd never met you. Kennedy had pushed it as far as she was willing for the moment. Rap would simply have to show the crotchety old bastard what she already knew. I have to head over to the farm to take care of something. I'll be back for dinner. She turned to head back to the car, and over her shoulder she yelled, And he'd better look no worse for the wear than the other six, or you're going to have one very unhappy niece on your hands. Chapter 3 Rapp watched Kennedy drive away, his heavy oversized lacrosse double bag hanging at his side. The scene was a bit surreal. It brought back memories of being dropped off at summer camp when he was 9 and watching his mom drive off. Just like today, he had gone of his own free will, but this time there were no tears in his eyes. Back then he'd been a boy afraid of the unknown. Today, he was a 23-year-old man, ready to take on the world. As the car drove down the lane, Rapp could feel the weight of his decision. A door was closing. He had picked one path over another, and this one was undoubtedly the one less traveled. It was overgrown and more treacherous than his imagination could do justice to, but then again his youthful self felt invincible and was filled with schemes to cheat death. He would undoubtedly be pushed to quit, but he was confident that wouldn't happen.
He'd never quit anything in his life, and he'd never wanted anything anywhere near as bad as he wanted this. Rapp knew the score. He knew how his chain would be yanked and jerked every which way, and he would be forced to endure all of it. The prize at the end was what it was all about, though, and he was willing to endure all of it for his chance. Rapp could feel the man's eyes on him. He let his heavy bag fall to the ground and watched him come closer. The man with the stash and the sunglasses blocked his view of the long driveway. Rapp instantly smelled the acid mix of coffee and cigarettes on his breath. He wanted to take a step back, but didn't want to appear to be backing down, so he stayed put and breathed through his mouth.
"Take a good look at that car," Hurley said sourly.
Rapp tilted his head to the side and watched the sedan disappear around the corner.
"She ain't coming back," Hurley added in a taunting voice.
Rapp nodded in agreement.
"Eyes front and center," Hurley snapped.
Rapp stared at his own reflection in the polarized lenses and remained silent.
"I don't know what kind of fucking bullshit you pulled on her. I don't know how you managed to con her into thinking you had what it takes to make it through my selection process, but I can promise you that every day you're here, you will curse her 1,000 times for walking into your life. But you better do it silently, because if I hear you utter one single unkind word about her, I will make you feel pain you never thought possible. Do you understand me?"
"Yes."
"Yes!" Hurley barked. "Do I look like one of your faggot college professors?"
"No," Rapp said without twitching.
"No?" Hurley howled with a veiny throat. "You call me sir when you talk to me, or I'll stick my boot so far up your ass you'll be chewing leather."
A fleck of spit hit Rapp in the face, but he ignored it. He'd figured something like this would happen. He'd already taken a look around and hadn't seen any others, so this was probably his best chance.
"Sir, permission to speak?"
"I should have figured," Hurley said with a sigh. He placed his hands on his hips and said, "All right, Ivy League, I'll give you this one chance to say your piece. I can only pray you're going to tell me this was a bad idea and you'd like to go home, and I've got no problem with that," he added quickly. "Hell, I'll drive you myself."
Rapp grinned and shook his head.
"Shit," Hurley drew out the word as he shook his head in disgust. "You actually think you can do this?"
"I do, sir."
"So you're really going to waste my time?"
"It appears so, sir, although, if I may, I suggest we speed things up a bit."
"Speed things up?" Hurley asked.
"Yes, sir. My guess is once you step in the ring with a man, you can probably figure out inside about 20 seconds if a guy has enough talent to make it through your selection process."
Hurley nodded.
"That's right.
I don't want to waste your time, so I say we find out if I have the goods."
Hurley smiled for the first time.
"You want to take a run at me?"
"Yes, sir. So we can speed things up."
Hurley laughed.
"You think you can take me?"
"From what I've heard, not a chance in hell."
"Then why are you in such a hurry to get your ass kicked?"
"I figure you'll do it sooner or later. I'd rather do it sooner."
"And why is that?"
"So we can get on with the important stuff."
"And what would that be?"
"Like you teaching me how to kill terrorists."
This was a first. Hurley took a step back and studied the new recruit. He was 6'1", and looked to be in perfect shape. But at 23, that was expected. He had thick, jet-black hair and dark, bronzed skin. He had the right look. Hurley sensed the first glimmer of what Kennedy had alluded to. More amused than worried, Hurley nodded his consent and said,
"All right, we'll have a go at it. You see that barn over there?"
Rapp nodded. "There's an open cot in there. It's yours for as long as you can last. Throw your crap in the footlocker and put on a pair of shorts and a t-shirt. If you're not ready and standing in the middle of the mat in 2 minutes, I'm sending you home." Rapp took it as an order. He grabbed his bag and took off at a trot for the barn. Hurley watched him duck inside, noted the time on his digital watch, and walked back to the porch where he set down his coffee mug on the edge of the glossy white floorboards. Without so much as glancing over his shoulder, he unzipped his pants and began to urinate on the bushes. Chapter 4 Rapp found the cot next to 3 bunk beds. It was standard military surplus.
Not great, but a hell of a lot better than the floor. After stripping to his underwear, he opened his bag and pulled out a pair of shorts and a plain white T-shirt. Kennedy had told him to pack only generic clothing. She didn't want him wearing anything that could give one of the other men an idea where he came from. They were all under strict orders not to discuss each other's past. Rapp folded up his clothes, placed them in the footlocker, closed it, and set the bag on top. He would have unpacked the bag, but he heard his instructor approaching. Rapp took up his position in the middle of the well-worn wrestling mat and waited eagerly for his shot. Hurley stopped near the entrance to the barn, took a long drag off his cigarette, and began to loosen up with a few side stretches and shoulder rolls. He wasn't expecting much of a fight, so after a quick calf stretch, he took one last puff of his cigarette, stubbed it out against the sole of his boot, and entered the barn. The new recruit was standing in the middle of the mat, wearing shorts and a T-shirt. Hurley gave him the once-over. He was fit, just like all the others, but there was a certain casual, relaxed posture that he found off-putting. "Shoulders back, eyes front and center." Hurley shook his head and mumbled some incoherent words to himself. "I don't have time to babysit." He bent over and took off his boots and socks and set them neatly at a 90-degree angle at the edge of the mat, socks folded on top. He took off his sunglasses and set them on top of the socks. Stepping onto the mat, he asked, "Rules?" Rapp didn't flinch. "That's up to you, sir." Hurley bent back, continuing his stretching, and said, "Since no one's here to monitor this little ass-kicking, I suggest we keep it civilized. Stay away from the balls and the eyes, and no throat strikes." "Chokeholds?" "Absolutely," Hurley grinned. "If you want it to end, all you have to do is tap out." Rapp shook his head. "Fair enough." Hurley caught his first glimmer of something he didn't like. There was no sign of tension on the kid's face. He looked as relaxed as a schmuck who was about to play a round of golf. Two possibilities presented themselves, and Hurley liked neither. The first was that the recruit might not be the little mama's boy that he thought, and the second was that he might be too stupid to know he wasn't cut out for this line of work. Either way, he might have to waste more than one day of his valuable time trying to drum him out. Hurley was shaking his head and muttering to himself when he realized there was a third possibility, that the kid actually might have the goods. The potential hazard made Hurley pause. He glanced at the young college kid and realized he knew surprisingly little about the man standing in the middle of the mat. The jacket he'd received from Stansfield was so sanitized that the pertinent details would have fit onto one page. Beyond the general physical description and test scores, every other piece of information had been redacted. The man was a blank slate. Hurley had no sense of his physical abilities and general bearing. He didn't even know if he was left or right-handed. A frown creased Hurley's well-lined brow as he ran through some more scenarios. Normally, when Hurley stepped onto the mat with a recruit, he already had the advantage of having read an extensive personnel file, as well as having watched them for several days. You could tell a lot about a man by observing him for a few days. He silently called himself a dumbass for not thinking of this sooner. There was no calling it off at this point. His bare feet were on the mat. If he called it off, it would be a sign of weakness. Hurley set his apprehension aside and reminded himself that he'd bested every man he'd run through here. He moved forward with his normal swagger and a lopsided grin on his face. He stopped 10 feet away and said, "Ready when you are." Rapp nodded, dropped into a crouch, and made a slow move to his left. Hurley began sliding to his right, looking for an angle of attack. He glimpsed this opening when his opponent made an aggressive head fake that was an obvious tell of what would follow. In that moment, Hurley decided to dispatch the kid quickly. He wasn't going to waste time with defensive blocks and holds. He was going to make this kid feel some real pain, maybe bust a couple of his ribs. That way, even if he proved to be a stubborn fool, there'd be no hope of his keeping up with the others. Hurley anticipated the punch, ducked into a crouch, and came in to deliver a blow to the kid's midsection. Right about the time he pivoted off his back foot and let loose his strike, he realized something wasn't right. The kid was a lot faster than he had anticipated. The little shit had doubled back on his own weak fake and was now a good 2 feet to the right of where Hurley had thought he would be.
It looked like he'd been suckered. Hurley knew he was horribly out of position and exposed, but he wasn't the least bit alarmed. He pulled back his punch and prepared to go back in again on a different angle of attack. He was in the process of delivering his second blow when he realized again that something was wrong. Hurley sensed more than saw the big left hook bearing down on his face. In the final split second before impact, he braced himself by pulling in his chin and dropping his hips. The crushing blow landed just above Hurley's right eye. Punches are funny things in that each one is different. You've got uppercuts, hooks, jabs, roundhouses, haymakers, and rabbit punches, to name a few. If you've sparred enough, you've felt all of them, and you learn to recognize each one by feel almost the instant it lands. A little scorecard in your head quickly analyzes the blow, and there's a brief conversation that takes place between the part of the brain that analyzes the thousands of instantaneous signals that come flying in and the part of the brain whose job it is to make sure the brain stays online. Hurley had been doing this for years, and as a man whose job it was to judge talent and teach, he had grown very accustomed to giving instant feedback to the man whose ass he was kicking. On this occasion, however, he was too busy trying to stay on his feet, so he kept his mouth shut. The punch hit him so squarely that Hurley actually went down to one knee for a split second. The turtle move had saved him from getting KO'd. If his head had been exposed any further, the force of the blow would have snapped his jaw around so quickly his equilibrium would have gone offline and he'd be down for a nice long nap. The ringside announcer in Hurley's brain made him aware of two things in extremely quick succession. The first was that he hadn't been hit this hard in a long time. The second was that he'd better launch a counterattack and do it quickly or he was going to get his ass kicked. Hurley pivoted from his back to his front foot and launched a flurry of combinations designed more to get this kid to back up than actually hit him. The first two were blocked, and the next five found nothing more than air. Hurley realized the kid must have been a boxer, and that meant he'd have to get him down on the mat and twist him into submission. No more punches. Before Hurley had a chance to regroup, he felt the leg sweep catch him perfectly in the ankle of his right foot, which happened to be bearing about 90% of his weight. What happened next was simple physics. The sweep took him out so cleanly that there was no hope of catching himself with his back leg, so Hurley went with it. He landed on his ass, tucked and rolled back, and sprang onto his feet. The fact that the kid had just swept him was not lost on Hurley. Boxers did not know how to use leg sweeps. There was a split-second pause while Hurley looked across the mat at the new recruit and wondered if he'd been lied to about his lack of military training. The respite didn't last long. Once again, Hurley found himself on the receiving end of a combination of well-placed punches. He had to get this kid down on the mat, or he really was going to get his ass kicked. He backed up quickly as if retreating for his life. The kid followed him, and when he launched his next attack, Hurley dropped down and slid in. He grabbed the lead leg and stuck his shoulder into the kid's groin while pulling and lifting at the same time. The kid tried to drop his hips, but Hurley had too good a hold. Hurley was about to topple him when a double-fisted hammer strike landed between his shoulder blades. The blow was so solid, Hurley nearly let go, but something told him if he did, he would lose, so he hung on for dear life and finally toppled the kid. Hurley was on top of him. He found a wrist and jammed his thumb into the pressure point while maneuvering the rest of his body into position for an arm bar. He rolled off and delivered a scissor kick to the throat of his opponent that, under the rules, was not exactly fair, but neither was their business. The kick barely missed, but Hurley had his opponent's wrist in both hands now and was ready to lean back and cantilever the kid's damn arm until he hyperextended the elbow. Before he could lock in the move, though, the kid did something that Hurley did not think possible. Rapp had somehow reversed into the hold and was now on top of Hurley, who still had a good grip on his wrist. Hurley's head, however, was now firmly locked between Rapp's knees. Rapp hooked his ankles together and began to close his knees in like a vise crushing a coconut. Hurley jabbed his thumb as deeply into the wrist of his opponent as he could. But it didn't get him to back off a bit. He could feel the early stages of a blackout coming on and scrambled for a way out. He released his left hand from the wrist hold and grabbed a handful of the kid's thick black hair. Instead of letting go, though, the kid squeezed his knees even harder. White lights were dancing at the periphery of his vision. Hurley couldn't believe he'd just had his ass handed to him by some college puke. Still, he did not stop looking for a way out, and with the darkness closing in, he found his answer sitting only a few inches in front of his face. He vaguely remembered a brief discussion about rules before they had started, but that wasn't important right now. Making sure he didn't lose was what was important. In a last-ditch effort to avoid calamity, Hurley released the opponent's wrist
and lashed out with his now free hand. He found the kid's gonads, and with every last ounce of strength he clamped down and began to squeeze. Chapter 5. Kennedy returned to the lake house just after 6 in the evening. She was tired, hungry, and not in the mood for another confrontation with Hurley. But there were certain developments that needed to be discussed. One of the unforeseen and increasingly difficult aspects of her job was the inability to communicate freely with her colleagues. Foreign intelligence agencies that operated in Washington were always a threat, but no longer her biggest concern. Now she had to worry about her own government and a new generation of journalists who wanted to break the next Watergate, Pentagon Papers, or Iran-Contra scandal. Combined, they had ended hundreds of careers and done untold damage to national security. It was the new sport in Washington to pound on the very agencies tasked with keeping America safe. Surprisingly, Kennedy was fairly ambivalent about it. As her mentor Thomas Stansfield had told her many times, great spies don't complain about the rules. They find ways around them. She parked the car in front of the house and climbed the porch steps, dreading the thought of going another round with Hurley. Kennedy opened the screen door and entered. The rooms to her left and right were empty, so she went down the center hall to the kitchen. Her feet stopped where the hardwood floor transitioned to linoleum. Sitting at the kitchen table was a bruised and battered Stan Hurley. He had a drink filled with ice and Maker's Mark pressed against a fat lip and a bag of ice held against his swollen right eye. Leaning against the counter directly across from him was Troy Cheetah, a 32-year-old former Green Beret and Hurley's right-hand man. Cheetah tried but failed to suppress his amusement over his boss's battered physical appearance.
"You think this is funny?" Hurley snarled.
"Absolutely not," Cheetah said with dramatic false sincerity.
"You prick, wait till I stick your ass in the ring with him. You won't be laughing after he lands a couple punches."
"What happened?" Kennedy asked, genuinely not sure what they were talking about. Hurley hadn't seen her enter because the bag of ice was covering his right eye, and he didn't hear her because his ears were still ringing. He turned his head and removed the bag of ice to reveal an eye that was so swollen it was almost entirely closed. The skin above the eye was a shiny, bulbous red.
"What happened," Hurley said in a voice rising with anger, "was that fucking Trojan horse you dumped in front of my house this afternoon."
It clicked, and Kennedy thought of Rapp. "You're saying my recruit did this to you?"
"Don't fucking play games with me. I am in no mood."
Hurley slammed his glass down on the table and grabbed the bottle of bourbon. He filled it to the brim. "I have no idea what you're talking about," Kennedy said sincerely. Hurley took a big gulp and said,
"My ass! He's your recruit. You give me some cut-and-paste fucking jacket on the guy that reads like a ransom note. I know nothing about him. He's here less than a minute, and he up and suggests we find out if he has the right stuff."
Hurley stopped to take another drink, and then, in a falsetto voice designed to mimic Rapp, said,
"Let's speed things up and find out if I have what it takes to do this."
"My recruit did that to you?" asked Kennedy, still not entirely sure what the man was talking about. Hurley slammed his glass down again. This time, brown liquid sloshed over the lip of the glass.
"Yes, goddammit, and don't stand there and act like this is a surprise to you."
He pointed an accusatory finger at her.
"You planned it. You set me up."
"I have no idea what you're talking about." Kennedy shook her head and asked, "Are you trying to say my recruit bested you?"
"Damn close."
Hurley turned his attention to his drink and mumbled to himself. "Your boy had him beat," Cheetah interjected with a smile, "but Stan here broke the rules and put the kid's balls in a vice."
"You think this shit is funny?" Hurley barked.
Cheetah smiled and nodded. Hurley looked like he was going to launch his glass across the room at him, and then, at the last minute, decided to use the bag of ice. Cheetah stuck out his right hand and caught the bag with ease.
"Don't be a baby. After all the asses you've kicked around here, it's about time you got a little taste." "My problem," Hurley shot back, "is getting ambushed by this young woman here. Someone I helped raise, by the way."
Hurley turned his one good eye back on Kennedy.
"No military experience, my ass. Where did you find this kid?"
Kennedy was still in a bit of shock. She herself had seen Hurley tie NFL-sized linebackers into pretzels. Nowhere in her research had she found anything that would lead her to believe Rapp was capable of going toe-to-toe with Stan Hurley. "Stan, you need to trust me. I had no idea he could best you."
"He didn't best me. He almost did."
"Yeah, but you cheated," Cheeto said, taking perverse pleasure in the torment he was causing Hurley. "So technically he beat you." It took every last bit of restraint to not throw his glass at the gloating Cheetah. Hurley turned his attention back to Kennedy and asked, "What are you up to? Why in hell would you try to sucker me like this?"
"Just calm down for a minute, Stan. I am telling you right now, we found nothing in our research that said he was capable of this." Kennedy gestured at Hurley's battered face. "It was my sincere hope that someday he would be able to do this, but not this soon."
"Then your research sucks. You don't learn how to fight like this in your basement. Someone has to teach you."
Kennedy admitted he's been going to martial arts studio for the past year.
"That would have been nice to know,"
Hurley fired back. "Stan, you have been bitching up a storm that this guy is a waste of time because he hasn't had special forces training. You think a year of training in a strip mall is equal to what the army puts guys through?"
"That depends on the instructor. And the student," Chida added.
Kennedy folded her arms and thought long and hard before she spoke. "There is one other possibility."
"What's that?"
"I know you don't like to talk about your age, but is it possible that you've lost a step?"
Cheetah started laughing so hard his big barrel chest was rising and falling with each chuckle. Hurley was seething. "I'm going to put your ass in a ring with him first thing in the morning. We'll see how funny you think this is then."
Cheetah stopped laughing. Kennedy pulled up a chair and sat at the table across from Hurley. "Please, tell me what happened."
"You're not jerking my chain?"
Kennedy shook her head.
"You weren't trying to pull a fast one on me, set me up?"
She shook her head again and said, "No. In fact, I was worried that he would be on the receiving end of a beating, not the other way around." Even through his anger and bourbon-induced haze, Hurley was starting to grasp that Kennedy was telling the truth.
"Where did you find this guy?"
Kennedy gave him a look that he instantly understood.
"Shithead," Hurley said to Cheetah, "go check on those clowns, and if they're screwing around, bust them out and make them snap off 100 up-downs."
"Got it." Cheetah moved out, all business. As soon as the screen door slammed, Hurley looked at Kennedy and said,
"Who is he?"
She couldn't keep him in the dark forever, but she would have preferred to wait a few more days. Setting her apprehension aside, she said,
"His name is Mitch Rapp."
Chapter 6 Rapp lay on his cot, his head propped up on a lumpy pillow, and a bag of frozen peas on his groin. Dinner had been served buffet-style on a folding table at the far end of the barn. His appetite wasn't really there, but he forced himself to eat. There were 7 of them, plus 2 instructors, and among them they polished off a giant pot of spaghetti, a plateful of rolls, and all the salad and corn on the cob they could stomach. The men were tired, hot, and ragged, but they stuffed their faces all the same and washed it down with pitchers of ice water and cold milk. Rapp had spent the last 5 years eating at a training table and knew how it worked. Tough drills and heat like this didn't exactly spur the desire to eat. It had the opposite effect, but you had to ignore it and shovel down the food. The physiology was pretty straightforward. They would be burning 5,000-plus calories a day, and that meant either they had to eat a ton of food or they would begin to lose weight. With his frame and current weight, Rapp could lose 10 pounds, but anything beyond that, and he would open himself up to injury and illness. Rapp tossed the copy of Time magazine on the floor and adjusted the bag of frozen peas. One of the instructors had pulled him aside as he was clearing his plate and told him he wanted him to get on his back and start icing. He then gave him strict orders to report any blood in his urine. Rapp simply nodded and took the bag of peas. After his sparring match and before dinner, he'd had a few hours to reflect on what had happened while one of the instructors led him through a tough circuit of calisthenics and then a 10-mile run through the woods. Rapp made it seem like he was struggling, but he wasn't, especially with the running. He could last all day if he had to, but he didn't want to show these guys too much too soon.
Besides, give a teacher the choice between a straight-A student who has all the answers and an earnest one who gets better over time, and they'll pick the earnest one every time.